This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Sanghas like ours in America are rapidly enacting a Buddhist equivalent of the Protestant Reformation, a reorientation of practice away from a monastic ideal, a practice mediated by a priesthood, towards one that's focused on householder practice in a lay context. And when this transformation took place in Christianity in Europe, it took place with enormous equanimity and rejection of a total rejection of one side by the other. In the case of American Zen Buddhism, lay practice and monastic or residential practice maintain a much closer and harmonious and hopefully synergistic kind of relationship where one supports the other. But they do involve different assumptions about the nature of practice and one might say the cultivation of different virtues in the course of practice. David Hume, writing in the 18th century, is a voice of the Scottish Protestant Enlightenment. Went so far as to denounce what he called monkish virtues, things like celibacy and penance and fasting and humility and solitude, saying that these were essentially obsolete and had no place or no, were in fact not virtues in the society in which he lived. The virtues that were expounded by the original Buddhist monastic community are also in some ways quite alien and inappropriate to householder practice of today. In fact, they were specifically defined by home leaving. And home leaving entailed cutting off attachment from family, not having personal relationships, and especially not sexual relationships. There was a assumption that one could embody Buddha's realization of interdependence and non-attachment and emptiness and impermanence by having no possessions, no fixed home, surviving on alms. All of these things are essentially incompatible with householder practice. So we have to try to understand what does it mean to adapt ourselves in this context without thinking that those forms of life are the purest expression of Buddha's realization. See, I would think that for us, our basic recognition is that impermanence and interdependence are manifest everywhere all the time. You don't have to go live a special life to encounter change and sickness and old age and death. The realities of impermanence are right here and right now, no matter where you're living. The realities of interdependence, of the myth of control or autonomy or separateness, that is proving itself over and over and over again, whatever we're doing. This is what Joko meant when she wrote that line in our chant, "Each moment, life as it is, the only teacher." Life as it is constantly banging you over the head with the reality of impermanence and interdependence. You don't have to go anywhere else to discover that. Now, I think Buddhism, like Christianity, and in some sense many other religions, have had a complicated relationship to the body, and that in many traditions the spiritual is defined in opposition to the physical, to the earthbound, whether or not they explicitly speak about another life or an afterlife or a transcendental realm or whatever. There's a sense in which a deep suspiciousness, if not hatred, of the body, and particularly of sexuality, is part and parcel of what was called spiritual. And it's reflected in the way celibacy is a big part of many monastic or religious traditions, East and West. And in the story of the Buddha's life, we have also the way in which an assumption that the mortification of the flesh, literally sort of the killing of the body, is considered a necessary part of spiritual discipline or spiritual development. In a similar fashion, fasting and various forms of physical hardship are designed to somehow separate us from our ordinary physical needs and desires. We hear stories, both East and West, of saints or, you know, bodhisattva-like figures who have attained such a high degree of spiritual development that they essentially don't have to eat anymore. Their body becomes independent of the physical needs of the rest of us. There was a book many years back that I seem to recall titled Spiritual Anorexia, which talked about that kind of confluence of spirituality and the attempt at disembodiment or some version of the purification of the physical. See, in contrast to this, I think that we, as householder practitioners, come to practice and come to the truth of Buddha's realization from a very different direction. We learn the inescapability of interdependency through our attachment to other people, to family, to our community, through our work, that we see that who we are is defined by our livelihood and our relationships. We see that autonomy is a myth. And while there's certainly an experience of loneliness, there is no such thing as truly being alone. That being non-separate is the reality of all our lives. And as I said before, the realities of change and impermanence inescapably present themselves to us. I have also suggested that in contrast to the early versions of spirituality that try to define it in contrast to the body, one of the best ways to come to terms with impermanence and interdependence is to simply realize I am my body. Right? It's not that I am a soul or a spirit inhabiting my body. It's not as if my body is an irrelevant husk that I'm seeking to slough off so that I can attain a higher state. It's not as if the self or the soul exists as a separate entity from my physical body and can be experienced, cultivated, or separated from it. It's not as if there is any aspect of me that will survive my body. But I think the most Buddhist approach we can take is to simply settle into the realization that I am my body. It undergoes change, it undergoes death and disillusion. While it exists, it is utterly dependent on its surround and on others. These realizations and this way of practicing and understanding are completely available to us in this life and this kind of setting. And it is the fulfillment, I think, of our mission as this representatives of Reformation Zen. That this understanding really be seen as whole and sufficient and standing its own ground. It is not a lesser or diluted version of monasticism. It is a full realization that can be seen, expressed, and transmitted in the middle of the life we have.